Very much appreciate your attentiveness last night. I enjoyed your questions, and especially some of the questions afterwards. I wish you had asked them during the speaking at the proper times, because there were some good questions that showed you really are attentive and interested in the things of God revealed to us in His Word. So it's good to be back with you again this morning. Now, as a pastor, sometimes I'm involved in counseling, and this is something I use in my counseling. It might help you, men, any men who are here. You know, they say a dog is a man's best friend, and there's a way to tell if your wife is your best friend or your dog. What you have to do, men, is try this. Lock them both in your trunk of your car for 1 hour, and when you open the lid, the one that's happy to see you is your best friend. Don't. Let me mention that I will be working from the New American Standard Bible. I forgot to ask what version you used before I came here, but that's the way my notes are organized. It'll be slightly different in reading from yours, but I think you'll be able to follow along quite well. Last night, we talked about Jesus and His Olivet Discourse, and we saw that was related to the destruction of the temple in the year 70. Today, we're going to look at John in his book of Revelation. And you might not be aware, but the Olivet Discourse is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but not in John's Gospel. I believe John has picked up on the Olivet Discourse through the ministry of Christ, the revelation of Jesus Christ to John, has picked up on the Olivet Discourse and is expanding and dramatizing it, because it's going to be dealing with the same issues, but from a different, more dramatic way. John's revelation is obviously a fascinating book. It's a dramatic exhibition of sound and of sight. It is a drama with much suspense in it. Yet most will agree that Revelation is the most difficult book in the Bible. I don't know anyone who's read it and said, well, this is easy. That's why I wrote a book called Revelation Made Easy. Try to break it down so that it'd be a little bit easier. And it's odd, because the name of the book is Revelation, which means to reveal or to open up something. Yet here we have the most difficult book in the Bible, called a Revelation, that is very obscure to us. And the technical commentaries aren't much help. Sometimes they're so dense, they're like a black hole and no light can escape from them. But the popular commentaries are even worse. They're absolutely unhelpful in many respects, because you'll find in too many popular commentaries on Revelation that you end up with an exposition of the news rather than an exposition of the Scripture. And we don't want to do newspaper exegesis. We want to do biblical exegesis when we're in the book of Revelation. And the popular commentaries obviously are constantly changing depending on what's going on in the Middle East today. So it's very hard to get a handle on the book of Revelation, and so many of the commentaries are not very much help to us. But since Revelation is a revelation from God, a revealing by God, and since it is so dramatic and so auditory and so visual, we might say that it is sound and fury signifying something. But what is it signifying? That's what we want to find out. And so we need to look into this book and carefully analyze some of the key features so that we'll have a better handle on it. And I hope this will open it up for you. Now, I've been studying and promoting an understanding of Revelation from this perspective I'll be presenting tonight for about 25 years. And I like to challenge Christians with this. And oftentimes when I'm challenging Christians, sometimes I feel like I'm talking to a wall that doesn't get through to some people. It's like a counseling situation. Here comes another one for you. Like the counseling situation where this couple comes into the counselor. They sit down across the desk from him. He says, "What can I do for you?" And the wife just takes off. She said, "He doesn't love me, doesn't remember my birthday, doesn't send me flowers, doesn't remember me on Mother's Day, doesn't give me Christmas presents, just doesn't take me out." On and on she went for about 15 minutes, and finally the counselor raised his hand and said, "Whoa, stop. I know what your problem is." He walked around the desk, picked the woman up in his arm, gave her a long, slow, passionate kiss, set her back down, went around his desk and sat down. He looked at the husband and said, "That's what she needs 3 times a week, and all your problems will be solved." The husband thought about it a minute, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll bring her in on Monday and Wednesday, but I go fishing on Friday." Not taking it very well. Sometimes I feel like that when I'm teaching Revelation to somebody who's not expecting my approach here. Well, I'm going to be offering 4 messages today. Obviously, we can't study the details of Revelation. The church has been debating this for 2,000 years, and Derek would not give me the amount of time I needed. I asked for just a couple centuries is all I asked for. He said, no, you get 4 hours. So we're going to try to get through this book in 4 hours. Yet I do hope that I can provide the keys that will unlock the mysteries and open your understanding of the book of Revelation in a new and remarkable way. These are the keys that you need to properly understand the book of Revelation as far as my perspective is concerned. And I think as you see these, you know, a light will go on with it. Now, this message deals with a crucial issue. This first message is absolutely essential. People coming in the second, third, and fourth messages, having missed this, they're going to be somewhat disoriented. But you are here. And in this message, we'll be dealing with John's expectation. That is, when does John expect these events to take place? Very crucial. And then we'll also be dealing in the next message with his theme. What does John expect to take place? So the when and the what, as you can imagine, are very important for understanding Revelation. And so this message, this first one we're about to receive, is foundational, not only for our conference, to get through the conference and understand what's going on here, but for understanding the book of Revelation itself, even after we leave this conference setting. I'm going to be focusing on the leading key to interpretation in this message today. Without this key, I believe the book of Revelation is locked to you. You will not understand Revelation as John intended it, because he has given us a key. It's in the front door of the book, and if we will seize the key and unlock the book of Revelation using that key, we'll be able to open the door and light will come out and we'll see what's going on in Revelation. And so listen carefully, check the scriptures as I go. It may challenge your assumptions. Perhaps you've already heard it through Derek or someone else, but if you haven't, it may challenge your assumptions. I will be following the outline that you have there, so I will rather clunkily follow that outline for you so that you can keep pace where I'm going and follow my train of thought. Now, John wrote, when he wrote, to those whom he knew and over whom he ministered. And so we must, as much as possible, put ourselves back in the first century sandals of the people living at that time to understand what John was talking about to them. He wrote that book to them. Now, I will be building the case. It won't be like the first 3 minutes you'll know, okay, I understand where everything going on. I'm going to be building the case, and I'll have to lay step by step along the way. So you're going to have to follow along. Hang on. I will be getting to a conclusion before we're done here. So again, I'm using the New American Standard, but I think you'll be able to follow me in your New King James Version. Well, let's consider first the audience relevance. As you put on the first century sandals and focus on John's original audience, we must recognize the relevance of what John is writing to these people 2,000 years ago. Notice first the churches addressed. The churches addressed. John is writing to 7 historical first century churches. Clearly, he's writing to particular historical individual churches in his day. Revelation 1:4, for instance, says, John, to these 7 churches which are in Asia, grace to you and peace. He is writing to the churches. They would receive this. They know they're in Asia, what we call Asia Minor today. He is writing to the 7 churches that are in Asia. In verse 11, he hears these words, what you see, write in a book and send it to these 7 churches in Asia, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamon, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. There are not only 7 churches, but they're specifically named churches or the cities that they're in. These were historical first century churches containing actual first century Christians who are receiving this first century document. So crucial, as I build a case, you're going to see how important that is. In Revelation chapters 2 and 3, we have what are called the letters to the 7 churches, which actually should be called the oracles to the 7 churches. They're not truly letters. But the 7 churches addressed are given specific exhortations and warnings. And if you read this with some knowledge of ancient Roman history and Asia Minor, you're going to find that he's dealing with historical situations that those people would have known, geographical locations that they would have known, and political allusions that they would have been a part of. Now, I don't have time to develop this, but I highly recommend these 3 books I have that mentioned in your notes there by William Ramsey, Colin Hemer, and Roland Wirth. Those are very helpful books. They explain the historical, geographical, cultural setting of these 7 churches. And you're going to see, if you were to read these books, you would see John is talking to them about their historical, geographical, and cultural settings. So it's written to first century Christians. Keep that in mind. Secondly, or capital B, the church is afflicted. John and those churches, those historical, literal, first century churches, were suffering. Verse 9 of chapter 1. John, who also am your brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and perseverance which are in Jesus. John and the seven churches are suffering together for their faith. He is, as a matter of fact, banished to the Isle of Patmos. That was a Roman penal colony off the coast in the Aegean Sea. So he's off the coast of Asia Minor in a penal colony. And he frequently urges in this book the concept of perseverance. For instance, in the letters to the seven churches, we read this in chapter 2:2, 2:3, 2:19, and 3:10. And so these people are suffering. He's urging them to hold on, to persevere. Because they're suffering, it'd be easy to defect and to leave Christianity. In fact, Revelation has a very deep concern for martyrs throughout the book. There are many references to those who lose their life for Christ. And one early passage is in Revelation 6, verses 9 and 11. Listen to these words. When he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain. These are people who died and now they're in heaven. For the word of God and for the testimony which they held. Verse 11. And it was said unto them that they should rest for a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren should be killed as they were. And this should be fulfilled. So notice these are dead persons in heaven who were slain for the faith, and they're waiting for other Christians on the earth to die and join them in heaven. This is a book dealing with suffering people. John is writing to particular churches about their grave circumstances. What is John telling these suffering churches and these martyrs? Do you think he's talking about nuclear war 2,000 years in the future and jet planes and things of that sort, as so much of the populist eschatological books say? I don't believe so. These people are suffering. They want to know what is happening now and whether they're going to live through this, whether they should maintain their faith in Christ because of their grievous suffering. And then capital C, the church is advised. Now you can tell I'm a preacher there. The church is addressed and afflicted and advised. There you go. That's a good three-point sermon. You can use that sometimes, won't you? Now she was looking at me, so apparently Michelle will be preaching this. You won't be doing that. Melissa. My own wife's name. My wife is named Melissa, not Michelle. And if I ever call her Michelle, she gets mad. Okay, capital C. The church is advised. John wrote to be understood. The title of the book is The Revelation, The Uncovering, The Exposure, The Revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to show him. This is a revelation, and it's something that is being shown to his bondservants, the things which must soon take place. Now, revelation means unveil or to uncover. He, John, is writing to those real afflicted first century Christians to open up something to them, something they need to know. He's not giving this book of Revelation to confuse them, even though it might confuse us today. He wrote it as a revelation to show them some things. And look at verse 3. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep the things written in it. The first century church received these letters and they were publicly read to them. When he's talking about reading, he's not talking about you at home in your quiet room reading this, although that applies to you today. Back then, not everybody had a Bible, so these letters, oracles to the seven churches, were sent to each church and they had a reader stand up front who would read it to them. So he says, blessed is he who reads and those who hear. They must hear, they must understand, because they are to keep the things which are written in it. So John originally wrote to seven first century churches who were suffering grievous circumstances, and he's telling them something that they must hear and they must keep. This book is directly and immediately relevant to them. By extension, it's relevant to us. Just like the letter to the Corinthian church, which talks about all their trials and struggles, dealt directly with them, by extension, it's available to us as well. We can learn from principles, but it's written directly to the Corinthians. Well, John is writing directly to the Asian churches. Let's see what he's got in mind. Secondly, contemporary expectation. This is undoubtedly the most important matter, in my opinion, for the whole interpretation of the book of Revelation. And it builds directly upon that foundation I just laid you about the relevance of Revelation. To understand Revelation, and I tell people when I'm interviewed on radio programs or at conferences or whatever, I tell people, read the first verse. Don't jump over to the beast and get to all the exciting things. Read the first verse. He wrote it first for a reason. John expressly informs them that he expects the events to soon take place. This verse is a surprise to modern evangelicals. They're too eager to jump over to get to the interesting stuff. But I want us to notice four angles emphasizing contemporary concerns for John. Okay, notice first, to emphasize the nearness, John employs varied expressions. He uses two terms here, soon, or your version probably says shortly, soon and near. The first term is tachos. That's not tacos for those of you who might be getting hungry. It's tachos. Our word tachometer comes from that. It tells how fast your car engine's running. And it means shortly or soon. Notice his stated purpose. And Christians, this is John talking. Whether you follow me or not, this is John. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants the things which must soon take place. John says that. The very opening of this book. Now, the Arnton Gingrich lexicon, which is the standard Greek-English lexicon of our day, translates this, tells us this word can mean with speed, at once, without delay, soon, in a short time. You can check, and I challenge those who disagree with this approach, I challenge them, check any modern translation you want to. I don't care what the translation is. All of them, bar none, will say something like shortly or soon. You're not going to find any other translation because that's what the word means. And the word, that same word, tachos, appears in Revelation 2:16, 3:11, 22, 6, 7, 12, and 20. John clearly expected these events to occur soon, not 2,000 years later. But the second term is there. Remember, we're talking about he uses varied expressions. He uses tachos. But his second term is ingus. There are two G's there. If I've got it written out, I can't remember if you've got it written out. But the GG makes an ENG sound. Ingus. Look at verse 3. Blessed is he who reads, and those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed the things which are written in it, for the time is near. And that word near there is ingus. The word ingus can be used in geographical circumstances, like something is near, close at hand. In fact, it means at hand. The ingus means at hand. In other words, at arm's length. Or it can be used temporally, of time frames. The Arnton Gingrich lexicon translates it as near or soon. For instance, its use of an approaching Passover in Matthew 26:18, the approaching of summer in Matthew 24:32, and the approaching of a festival in John 2:13. So it's dealing with something about to happen. Christians, if you don't understand the first term that says soon, then there's another term two verses later that says near. Both of these are mutually supportive, and they underscore the idea of temporal nearness, nearness in time. How else could John have said that these events are soon any better than the way he said them, that they're soon because the time is near? If you take those terms away from him, how's he going to explain that these are soon or near? John used those words. Capital B. To emphasize nearness, John employs strategic placement. Strategic placement. Not only do these two terms identify the time frame, not only are they close together, but they are placed in the opening of the book of Revelation and at the close of it, at the introduction and the conclusion. He states his expectation as he begins and as he closes. In other words, he tells the people what he's going to talk about as something near, and then he closes by saying, remember, I told you these events are near. And thus, before the reader has any idea of what he's going to say, the first words they hear out of the reader's mouth have to do with these events are soon because the time is near. These comments should govern their understanding as they receive this revelation fresh. Without any help from Hal Lindsey, Tim LaHaye, they don't have all that construct in their minds. They receive this book of Revelation, and it says these events are near and soon at the beginning and end. Notice how Revelation 1 has exact parallels with Revelation 22, the last chapter of the book. Revelation 1:1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his bondservants the things which must soon take place. Chapter 22:6, these words are faithful and true, and the Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show his bondservants the things which must soon take place. Exact parallel, beginning and end. And then also notice that this is pre and post-drama. In other words, it's in the didactic portions. Before he gets into the dramatic symbols and seven-headed beasts and all that, right at the beginning in the didactic portions, and at the end as he's closing, after all this dramatic imagery, John tells the people that he is dealing with events that have to do with near time frame in their own experience. And so when he places these time indicators at the beginning and at the end, they must be important because they introduce you to the book of Revelation and tell you what to expect, and then they remind you when it's over, this is what you just heard about. And so the original hearers should not have thought, maybe this is 2,000 years in the future and there are nuclear weapons and rockets and things of that sort. No, they would not have thought that. Capital C, to emphasize nearness, John provides significant instruction. Revelation draws on Daniel in many respects. Now, I think the most influential book in the Old Testament for John is Ezekiel. But second to, in fact, we don't have time to do this. This is for next year's conference, okay? I'm going to be here eating your good food again. You should eat this woman's soup that she made for me last night and for the family. And what we have here is in the book of Revelation, John acting like an Old Testament prophet, and he's even picking up on Ezekiel, and especially in Daniel secondarily. Well, Daniel's influence comes to bear here. Daniel 12:4 says, as for you, Daniel, conceal these words, seal up the book until the end of time. But the angel tells John something the opposite, Revelation 22:10. He said to me, do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is near. The angel told Daniel, seal it up for the distant day. The angel tells John, don't seal it up, for the time is near. Don't you see that there's some kind of reflection on Daniel going on? This concept of Daniel is now coming to pass in John's revelation. Daniel seals because it's distant, and John is told, don't seal it because it's near. How could it be any more clear? And then D, to emphasize nearness, John offers frequent repetition. John is serious and emphatic, and you've got to feel the relentless drumbeat going on in the book of Revelation. Not only does he introduce and conclude it, but we're going to see that he deals with this over and over again in the book of Revelation. Now, John speaks of Jesus' coming in judgment in the first century. He's not talking about the literal second coming, a bodily coming, but he's using coming language, Jesus' coming, as a metaphor to speak of divine judgments in history. When God judges a nation such as Israel for rejecting the Messiah, it's as if God is coming against them. Jesus is coming against them. We're going to see that more in the next message. But so when you hear the word coming, your mind might jump to the second coming, but in the context, it's defined as near. So he's not dealing with the second coming. He's dealing with a metaphorical coming of Jesus against those in that day. Let me just read these. Revelation, verse 1:1. Revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants the things which must soon take place. Verse 3, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and keep the things written, for the time is near. chapter 3, verse 11, I am coming quickly, hold fast what you have. And that's written to the seven churches, or one of the seven churches. They are told he's coming quickly, hold on. So there's some sense in which Christ is coming in judgment. Chapter 6, 11, there was given to each one of them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest for a little while longer. Chapter 10, 6, he swore by him who lives forever and ever that there shall be delay no longer. 22, 6, the Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show his bondservants the things which must soon take place. Verse 7, behold, I'm coming quickly. Verse 12, behold, I'm coming quickly, and my reward is with me. Verse 20, yes, I'm coming quickly. Therefore, Revelation emphasizes from beginning to end the nearness of the judgment coming of Jesus Christ against his enemies. And he uses several words, uses them in the opening and the conclusion. He's doing something exactly the opposite of what Daniel did. He's unsealing prophecies because the time is near, whereas Daniel sealed them because the time was far away. And so we see very clearly that John is emphasizing the nearness of the events of Revelation. Well, capital E, let's consider a common evangelical objection. Some will object, yes, he does say that, but he's speaking of God's timing, not man's. Scripture says, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. Well, how shall we respond? Well, I would note two things. The first is this. John is writing to men, not about God. He does talk about God, but the first and foremost thing we've got to recognize is he is writing to the seven churches in Asia Minor. He's writing to them. Peter stating a theological truth that, as a matter of fact, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, because he's the eternal one. John is urging human directives. Peter stating a theological truth, John is urging human directives. So we have to make that distinction. But secondly, John is writing to seven specific churches who are in dire circumstances. They are in tribulation, according to Revelation 1, 9, 2, 9, and 10, and verse 13. They need patience, according to Revelation 1, 9, 2, 2, 10, 13, 25, and 3, 10, and 11. They must expect judgments in these various verses that I have listed for you there. He would be mercilessly taunting those people in those dire circumstances as if he were up there saying, you may be suffering, you may be dying, you may become martyrs, there may be others going to heaven to join the martyr band, but these events will soon happen in the way God evaluates time. No. He's talking to those real people who were suffering real grievous circumstances about what they were to experience. When the people at the foot of the altar in Revelation 6 say, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not avenge our blood upon those who dwell upon the earth? He says, the response from heaven's throne is, wait a little while longer. A little while longer. Don't wait hundreds and thousands of years. And in chapter 10, verse 6, the angel says, there will be no more delay. And so clearly, he's dealing with issues that are near. He's not talking about how God experiences time. He's talking about what man should do with the time they've been given. Okay, in conclusion, Revelation is written to real historical people about their real circumstances, their grievous circumstances. John clearly states that he expects the events to occur soon. They don't have the late great planet Earth to guide them. They don't have Left Behind to explain what's going on. They have to approach it fresh, and John is writing to them in their own circumstances, telling them these things. So go home and check any version you might have at your house and see if Revelation 1, 1 and 3 has anything other than soon or shortly or near. All the lexicons that you can check, if you were to check a Greek lexicon, would translate it like we have been. The Arndt Gingrich lexicon, Thayer's lexicon, Abbott Smith, Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, the Exegetical Dictionary of the New Testament, Theological Lexicon of the New Testament. I've looked this up in all of them, and they all agree these events are near. Strong's Concordance, even. Look it up there. And so in our conference, we're going to be seeing that the near expectation fits perfectly with the catastrophic events that occur in the first century around the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Christians, we have to understand that Revelation is what we call occasional literature. That is, It is written in response to particular historical occasions, issues, and circumstances. It's not like the Proverbs. The Proverbs don't have anything directly to do with some particular occasion. They're general principles, general maxims. This book is directed to real historical Christians suffering grievous circumstances. Paul's letter to the Romans was literally written not to the church here, but to the church at Rome. You can benefit from that because it is the Word of God, but it was written to the Romans, real living first century Christians. Galatians, the letter to the Galatians, was written to the Galatians who were having trouble with the Judaizers of the day. We can learn lessons from that, but it was written to them. It is an occasional epistle. The same is true of the Corinthians epistles. He wrote to real first century Christians about the man who had his mother's wife, about those who were eating food offered up to idols. All these things were written directly to them because these are occasional epistles. The same is true of Revelation. John wrote to seven real suffering churches. We must not be guilty of abstracting the content of Revelation from its real historical setting. We must interpret it according to the grammatical historical exegesis as the original recipients would have received this. And John wrote right up front the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to show to his bondservants the things which must soon take place. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy of this book and keep the things therein, before the time is near. And John specifically reminds them in Revelation 22, 6 and 10 of those things that he's dealing with. Clearly, the book of Revelation expected these events to occur soon. But what are these events? We'll have to wait till the next message to see what he's talking about directly.